began. "Young men starting out in life often ask me, 'How do you become an internee?' Well, there are various ways. My own method was to acquire a villa in northern France and wait for the German army to come along. This is probably the simplest plan. You buy the villa and the German army does the rest." Somebody, it would be nice to know who, I hope it was Goebbels, must have vetted this and decided to let it go out as a good advertisement for German broad-mindedness. The funny thing is that the broadcast landed Woodhouse in an infinity of trouble with the British authorities, representing a nation that prides itself above all on a sense of humour. Ludwig in The Joke must have known the feeling. Annoyed by his girlfriend Marquetta, who is an upright type and a wholesome citizen, and irritated by her praise of the healthy atmosphere at a party school she has attended, rather than spend a week of debauchery with him, he sends an impulsive postcard saying, "Optimism is the opium of the people. The healthy atmosphere stinks. Long live Trotsky," and signs his name. And that's all it takes. The difficulty with all this, from the radical standpoint, is as follows. Humour is easily enough definable as a weapon of criticism and subversion, but it is very often a mere comfort or survival technique. Ancient authorities understood this well, providing feasts of misrule to entertain the vassals and laying on licensed jesters and fools into the bargain. I've always thought that it must be this that impelled Nietzsche to define a joke as an epitaph on a feeling. The feeling has hardly arisen when it is dissolved or dissipated in a burst of mirth or bathos. An unforgettable moment in Dr. Zhivago puts the cynic Komarovsky in the saddle. A salon of bourgeois riffraff falls silent and uneasy as the crowd of workers sings the revolutionary anthem underneath the balcony. He punctures the tension by exclaiming, "Perhaps they'll learn to sing in tune after the revolution." It's often said that radicals are humourless. This is certainly not intended as a compliment to the seriousness that they must affect. How wounding is the charge, or how wounding ought it to be? There are not many jokes in Zola who actually relied more on sarcasm for some of his effects. Nor is the work of George Orwell very rib-tickling, though he could be witty enough at his own expense. By the way, what is often really meant by the supposed humourlessness of their radicals is their supposed inability to laugh at themselves. But why should they accept an invitation to consider their grand schemes absurd? Marx was often very funny. I don't know of any Gramsci or Luxembourg gags at the nadir of the left in 1915, when he was trying to convene the few remaining delegates for a much-persecuted anti-war conference at Zimmerwald, Trotsky found time to observe that you could now get all of the internationalists in Europe into three stagecoaches. I'm a partisan of the pro-wit radical faction myself, and that's why I so much admire Oscar Wilde, who was heading for exile and death in France at about the time that Zola was crossing the channel in the other direction to escape his own persecutors. But I have to admit that this faces us with an apparent paradox of a kind that even Wilde might have found unyielding. The paradox is phrased most tautly by Jean-Paul Sartre in his essay on Baudelaire. Yes, Sartre, not usually considered natural comic material, until the Monty Python team decided to concentrate on the lighter side of L'être et le néant. Sartre distinguished between rebels and revolutionaries. The rebel, he says, secretly quite wants the world and the system to remain as it is. Its permanence, after all, is the guarantee of his continuing ability to rebel. The revolutionary, in contrast, really wishes to overthrow and replace existing conditions. The second enterprise is obviously no laughing matter. As I write this, I realise that I am glad that there were no late-night comedians during the Dreyfus affair. There are times when one wants to hold society's feet to the fire and to force a confrontation and to avoid the blandishments of those who always call upon everyone to lighten up and change the subject. I think that many great and stern radicals did not lack a sense of humour, as the royalist faction liked to say of the Cromwellian parliamentarians, for example, so much as they felt themselves obliged to be serious. After all, Cromwell did tell his Puritan fighters to put their faith in God and keep their powder dry, which is also wryness of a kind. And Tom Lehrer stopped singing when Henry Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize on the grounds that satire is dead. He was witty enough to know when to keep quiet, which many comedians are not. Since I am on both sides of this crucial issue, I may as well stay where I am. Humour ought to be pointed, ought to preserve its relationship to wit, and it ought to be fearless. The easiest forms it takes are those of caricature. The clever politician already knows enough to make an offer for the original cartoon as a show of his good-heartedness and tolerance, and associated forms of mimicry. The mordant forms it takes are the ironic and the obscene. Probably only the latter two forms can be revolutionary. Some dirtbag politician or time-server will not in fact try to buy the original of a cartoon that shows him in the very act of treating his female staff as if they were campaign donations, which is why such truthful cartoons never in fact appear. Nor will a king join in the joke if he is represented as flailing impotently in a four-poster bed or shown crouching and fuming grimly on a lavatory throne. The great caricaturists of the past were prepared to shock people beyond reason in showing the simple fact that our masters are made from the same damp clay as we are. That's why they, the caricaturists, that is, like Daumier, often went to jail. A rule of thumb with humour, if you worry that you might be going too far, you have already not gone far enough. If everybody laughs, you have failed. As for the ironic, I shan't attempt a definition here. It's the gin in the Campari, the X factor, the knight's move on the chessboard, the cat's purr, the knot in the carpet. Its elusive and allusive nature is what makes it impossible to repress or capture. It has a relationship to the unintended consequence. One of its delights is that it can be deployed literally. Voltaire, for example, solemnly added up all the claimed splinters and fragments of the true cross as they were displayed in the reliquaries of Christendom and deduced carefully that the man who had once hung from such an immense artifact must have been a giant. His impiety only worked because it took faith at face value. Since irony is always ready to jog the elbow and spoil the plan of anyone engaged in a high task, and since, if it can be detected at work anywhere, its fingerprints can be found on history, it will have its say most firmly but delicately with anyone claiming to have history on his or her side. Bear this ever and always in mind when you hear the tuneful heralds of any grand new epoch. Meanwhile, it could be worth bearing in mind that if you really care about a serious cause or a deep subject, you may have to be prepared to be boring about it. Chapter 17. You ask if I am serious about being boring. Let me see if I can resist the temptation to attempt a witty reply. In modern mass society, at any rate, the dissenting type is unlikely to be faced with the gibbet or the prison cell, or even with the threat of unemployment or starvation. These things do, of course, still happen, and they happen a lot in the countries that produce the raw materials for our prosperity, but most of the time the enemy wears a banal face. This is why many minority causes lay so much emphasis on style and on the getting of attention by theatrical tactics, most of them subject to a rapid process of diminishing returns. A possible solution is to accept the banal and simply keep droning on. I'll give you an example from my own life. In 1992, Governor Clinton of Arkansas ordered the execution of a mentally retarded death row inmate, a black man named Ricky Ray Rector, who had lobotomized himself in an attempt to commit suicide. I'll spare you all the details. Rector used to save his dessert at mealtimes, and had saved the pecan pie for later, when the executioners came to take him away from what he'd been told was his last meal. He didn't even understand the charges against him. It was quite obvious that were it not for a tight primary race in New Hampshire that spring, he would have got either a stay of execution or even a commutation of sentence. I wrote a column or two about this piece of cold-blooded savagery and hoped for a response. But it became clear that the usual bleeding-heart liberal types were going to keep silent about this atrocity because they thought they had found a candidate for the presidency who would suit their needs. So I decided to become a bore. I would insist on mentioning the case whenever I wrote about the governor, who did succeed in becoming president and who didn't disappoint me, and I banged on about it whenever I was interviewed on radio and TV, or whenever I was asked for my views by a correspondent of any overseas news organization. My pledge to myself was that I would make the forgotten Mr. Rector as famous as if he'd been executed by a typical law-and-order Republican. Of course, I missed that mark. If he'd been executed by a vote-grubbing right-winger, he would have been world-famous right away. But over the course of 8 years, I did find that people began to react as if they had heard the story. Indeed, I was sometimes greeted with, "Oh, not that again," or "You seem obsessed by this," or, my favourite, "Can't we move on?" However, tedium is its own reward, and in the year 2000, taking part in a TV panel on the elections, I mentioned George Bush's awful toll of lethal injections in Texas. The chairman, who barely knew me and who had no politics, broke in to say, "But how is that worse than Clinton executing that crippled black man, Mr. Rector?" He spoke as TV people do, as if everyone would get his point. My mouth did spring open, but I'm glad to say that, remembering the admonition about the gift horse, I had the presence of mind to close it again. So, I entreat you, have no fear of being thought a monomaniac. If you catch yourself being one, that may be different. It is one of those indicative insults that betrays the prickings of a poor conscience on the other side, or among those who have been easy on themselves. It should be a spur to further droning on your part. My battle-hardened father, who to his credit tried, even as he failed, to avoid reminiscing too much about the war, once told me that warfare consisted of long periods of tedium punctuated by brief moments of terror. I've since heard this confirmed by many veterans, and in the few war zones I've briefly visited, had the chance to discover its truth for myself. Much depends, therefore, on how one handles the tedious part. The life of a radical is not dissimilar. Barricades and bastilles are not everyday occurrences. It's important to be able to recognize and seize crux moments when they do appear, but much of the time one is faced with quotidian tasks and routines. There's an art and a science to these things. The art consists in trying to improvise more inventive means of breaking a silence, and the science consists in trying to make the periods of silence bearable. Few things, for example, are more forbidding than the elementary civic duty of taking up the case of the wrongfully imprisoned. Visits to the jail, writing letters to indifferent elected officials, meeting with demoralized or paranoid relatives, sessions with lawyers. The Dreyfus moment almost never comes. A lot of class warfare can be the same way, keeping up the spirits of the strikers who have no savings, looking up dismal and complex records to find out where the corporation has hidden its money, trying to interest a reporter in telling the story honestly. In the case of some ground-down or ethnically cleansed faraway country, explaining to uncaring people where it is on the map and why it might either matter to them or be, in some way they may not wish to hear, their own responsibility. I don't mean to make any of this appear to be soul-destroying. It will only seem like that if you hope for instant results. The great reward, if that's the right word, lies in the people you will meet when engaged in the same work, the lessons you will learn, and the confidence you will acquire from having some experiences and convictions of your own to set against the received or third-hand opinions of so many others. Chapter 18. Dante was a sectarian and a mystic, but he was right to reserve one of the fieriest corners of his inferno for those who, in a time of moral crisis, try to stay neutral. So, since you ask me to go on less like a whiskered veteran and say a bit more about the art than the science, I shall try and be obliging. Again, I'm going to mention some examples from my own limited experience. I always feel slightly self-conscious about doing this, but at least the stories are first-hand, and I have noticed myself that when reading the work of other authors, I never resent the autobiographical. So I shall pretend that I am a stranger to all forms of modesty, including the false. I have been arrested a few times in various countries, and roughed up a few times as well, and once spent a brief time in jail in Prague during the dying days of the Stalinist regime. I have also heard the occasional shot fired in anger. But most of this was, if I am to be frank, the result of pretty minor and marginal engagements in which I chose to involve myself. I once made a speech at a street rally against an apartheid-era South African cricket team, which led the British police to grab and hold me on a charge of incitement to riot. I remember distinctly being disappointed as well as relieved when that charge was dropped. There had been something flattering in this tribute to my rhetorical skill. So, you see, I've done mainly summer soldiering. The war in Bosnia-Herzegovina in the early 1990s changed all that for me and for many other people I knew. It might sound provincial and, oh dear, Eurocentric to say this, but not even those of us who had taken the gloomiest view of the arms race and the Cold War had ever expected to see a full-dress reprise in Europe of internment camps, the mass murder of civilians, the reinstitution of torture and rape and deportation as acts of policy. This was the sort of thing we had read about from 6 decades before. Some of us, including myself, had met and got to know some survivors of that period. And, of course, in a recess of our minds, we had played the imaginary game. What would I do about the knock on the door? How would I react if the neighbours were being marched off to the station? That tired analogy turned out to be uncomfortably useful, because when all this ghastliness did get underway again, the political class in Europe and America behaved for the most part with the same wretched combination of complacency and complicity that it had exhibited when fascism first came to call. I haven't got the space to tell the full story here, but I'll do some polemical itemization of the main headings. 1. In the 20th century, which was forced to invent the word genocide, the Ottoman Turks had exterminated the Christian Armenians, and the Nazi Germans had tried to eliminate all the Jews. Both outrages took place under the cover of a wider war, and in occupied or disputed territories where there were few independent witnesses. The attempt to destroy the Muslims of Bosnia took place in broad daylight and was captured on film, and was the cause of the war and not a vile subtext of it. 2. Bosnia had a Muslim plurality but had long been a multicultural polity. Many Muslims were themselves secular. The capital city of Sarajevo was a place of mingling and synthesis, where large communities of Serbs, Croats, Jews and Bosniaks did rather more than merely coexist. 3. Unlike Serbia and Croatia, the two main contending parties in the Balkan Wars, Bosnia did not have, and never has had, any claims on anyone else's territory. The assault on Bosnia and the brutish siege of Mostar as well as Sarajevo was concocted in advance by an agreement between two ostensible rivals, the nostalgic fascist Mr. Tudjman and the born-again national socialist Mr. Milosevic. This mini-Hitler-Stalin pact was known about by NATO and can be confirmed in the records kept by the participants. 4. Since the aggression against Bosnia openly involved a declared wish for territory and a declared distaste for the existing inhabitants, it very quickly disclosed itself as a war of massacre. We want the land and not the people. Always look to the language. The term cleansing was bluntly employed on Belgrade TV to describe the process of emptying and ruining the flourishing towns along the river Drina. And always look to the aesthetic also. Most of the destruction and desecration of Bosnia's mosques and cemeteries and cultural sites took place during ceasefires, as part of a planned erasure that scorned the disguise of collateral damage. 5. Serbian and Croatian irredentists and cleansers openly fought under the banners of their respective Christian Orthodox and Roman Catholic faiths and were often blessed by priests and prelates. The Bosnians resisted for the most part as Bosnians. The upshot was that they were invariably described as the Muslims, whereas no broadcast ever reported that today Catholic forces destroyed the bridge at Mostar, or Orthodox bombardment set fire to the National Library of Bosnia in Sarajevo. 6. Given the uneven way that borders and populations actually intersect, in Europe and the Balkans and the Caucasus, it would be suicidal to allow the forcible triumph of a demagogic and dictatorial regime which sought to impose the tyrannical notion of congruence between race and state. This would negate the whole idea of Europe, not to say civilization, and could only lead to more war and further despotism. This was obvious to me in 1992 and seems even more plain today. What to do about all this? Bosnia, which had an elected government but not much of an army and which rotated its vice-presidency between Muslims, Croats and Serbs, asked for international protection and, failing that, for a recognition of its right to self-defence. Both proposals were rejected under the terms of a hypocritical arms embargo that ignored the seizure by Serbia of the arsenal of the former Yugoslav National Army. In rather the same way, the international powers had refused to arm the Spanish Republic, leaving it defenceless against Hitler and Mussolini and, not incidentally, forcing it to turn to Stalin's fraternal and asphyxiating embrace. So, like a number of other people, I decided to send myself to Sarajevo. I did this in the full awareness that I might present a ridiculous figure. I did it in the full consciousness that vicarious participation in such events has a slightly sinister as well as a slightly farcical past. But when I examined all this, and a few other things too, I realized that I had no excuse not to go. If I could be of no help, that would become evident. If I was making myself absurd or getting in the way, I could count on certain people to tell me. In the result, it's the moment in my life of which I'm the most proud. I have written about this as much as I can elsewhere, and won't inflict the whole narrative upon you. However, you should get and read Joe Sacco's cartoon history, Safe Area Garajda, to which I was honoured to contribute an introduction. Mr. Sacco's pictorial style as a moral draftsman and mordant observer will be famous one day. Of that I can absolutely assure you. New forms of the artistic register are one of the infallible signs of an authentic moment. In Sarajevo, which was being bombed and shelled around the clock, and which I had to reach by hitching a ride on a Luftwaffe humanitarian flight, glad that I'd never have to explain this to my late father, I saw people at their best, being maltreated by people at their worst. The population was stubbornly refusing to let the chauvinists be its teachers. Insulted and bullied in the name of ethnicity and religion, it simply refused to reply in kind. The deputy commander of the Bosnian armed forces, a gallant soldier named General Jovan Divjak, was a Serb. I interviewed him under fire. The assistant editor of the main daily paper, Oslobodjenje Liberation, was a Serb named Gordana Knežević. I became a fundraiser for this courageous daily after its buildings were razed by deliberate bombardment. It never missed an edition. I also became friendly with its Muslim editor, a man who hated racism and tribalism with a real passion. I understood going in, as they say, to beware of over-idealizing the Bosnians and to suspect the utopian tourist in myself and others. The model text here is Orwell's Homage to Catalonia. It was surprising and confirming to find how often it came up in discussions. Bosnian official propaganda took an internationalist tone. It described Milosevic's army and auxiliary death squads as Chetniks, an old anti-fascist term, rather than as Serbs. Death to fascism, not a bad slogan, was inscribed on posters everywhere. I still have framed on my wall a modest poster that was too intricate for wall poster display and that I found in a government office that was hit by a mortar shell a few moments after I left it. Gens una sumus, we are one people, was the superscription. Beneath was a design that incorporated the Catholic and Orthodox crucifixes, the Star of David, and the Star and Crescent. Just for once, I thought, it's okay to represent diverse peoples by religious symbols. There were a few gaunt and sectarian and fundamentalist types on the scene, and there were some gangsterism and corruption too, but these things were debated openly and much criticized, and were thought of as letting down the cause rather than exemplifying it. More important still, in a way, was the fact that Serbian and Croatian oppositionists and Democrats, half stifled by a miasma of superstition and xenophobia in their own societies, looked on the defense of Bosnia as a survival issue for their own cause as well. I still become incensed when I remember the arguments of those who thought that it didn't matter. The British Foreign Office and the French Presidency and the emerging czars of the Yeltsin regime all wanted to placate the insane, wicked scheme of Greater Serbia. I say placate because the term appease has become worn out by repetition. A preponderance of the American establishment felt the same way, and so did a large element of the official left, whether because it was nostalgic for Tito's Yugoslavia, or whether because, this was the American case, it had a conditioned response to anything that might trigger intervention. All the tired official rhetoric of so many years of deterrence and vigilance, all the propaganda about never again, and all the half-baked themes of isolationism seemed to merge into one stream of euphemism and evasion and hypocrisy. It culminated, as you may remember, with some 10,000 men and boys being butchered after the surrender of Srebrenica, while superpower satellites recorded the proceedings from overhead, and while the commander-in-chief of the pogromists was being received by Western and Russian diplomacy as a partner in peace. I found that I could not eat enough to vomit enough. I dwell on this memory for two reasons that bear on our relationship. First, you may have to be pompous as well as boring. I thought then, and I think now, that the defense of Bosnia-Herzegovina was a civilization question, that if we had let Bosnia and its culture and civilization be obliterated, we would stand exposed as hollow and worthless. Try saying that to an indifferent audience. They will wonder who you think you are, and so, if you are any good, will you? But if you believe it, then bloody well say it and remember what a small risk, relatively or comparatively, you are running. Second, do not worry too much about who your friends are or what company you may be keeping. Any cause worth fighting for will attract a plethora of people. I have spoken on platforms with communists about South Africa and with cold warriors about Czechoslovakia. In the case of Bosnia, I spoke with Muslims who disagreed with me about Salman Rushdie and Jews who suspected me because I have always supported statehood for the Palestinians. Nor did we agree to bury these disagreements, though we sometimes moved them to a higher plane. I remember Susan Sontag very bravely, in front of a pro-Bosnian audience that was heavily Turkish, insisting on the parallel with Armenia. Those who try to condemn or embarrass you by the company you keep will usually be found to be in very poor company themselves. In any case, they are, as I was once taught to say, tackling the man and not the ball. In point of fact, I have never found myself in the same galère as an outright fascist, and I have never found, even when making common cause with neo-conservatives, that I'm in the same camp as Henry Kissinger. so there may be some platonic discrimination that saves one from the worst and acts as a kind of unseen compass. Bosnia also did something else, which touches on a subject I mentioned at the opening of our exchange. It brought together the best of the 68ers and the 89ers, and showed that there had always been a potential symbiosis of the two. In Sarajevo and Mostar and Tuzla and Zagreb and Dubrovnik, I repeatedly met, without any arrangement to do so, just the people I remembered, and I might have hoped to encounter from earlier battles. I mustn't idealize this either, if only because there were some notable absentees, but writers and militants who had for years been gesticulating at each other across the petrified frontiers of old Europe, hoping to kindle an argument and a dialogue, and who had been eloquent against bloc politics and wooden language and the pulverizing fear of nuclear extinction, heard the signals from Sarajevo. They helped a worthwhile society to outlive the Hitler-Stalin pact between Tudjman and Milosevic, and to outlive Tudjman and Milosevic themselves. "The owl of Minerva," says Hegel, "takes wing only at dusk." He meant by this that a historical era can only be evaluated as it draws to a close. In bloody Bosnia, I realized that all the disparate and random struggles in which some of us had participated earlier could be made by this recognition of a hinge or crux moment to make more than retrospective sense. The next phase or epoch is already discernible. It is the fight to extend the concept of universal human rights and to match the globalization of production by the globalization of a common standard for justice and ethics. That may sound mild to the point of the herbivorous. I can assure you it will not be in the least a moderate undertaking. It will provide more than enough scope for the most ambitious radical. It was touch and go for a while in Bosnia, a damned near-run thing. But eventually the force of example was enough to get even the United Nations and the grand diplomacy of the old chancelleries wheezing and clanking into action also. That intervention brought problems of its own and cynicism of its own, but as William Morris put it so finely in The Dream of John Ball, men fight and lose the battle, and the thing that they fought for comes about in spite of defeat, and when it comes it turns out not to be what they meant, and other men have to fight for what they meant under another name. That is as dialectical as anything in Hegel or Marx, and as ironic as anything in George Eliot. Incidentally, this is not a primer or a reading list, but the work of William Morris and his circle on social and aesthetic questions is one of the most heroic and beautiful chapters in the history of radicalism, and will repay your study many times over. It is utopian in the most generous sense of the word. My old mentor and friend, Robert Conquest, another single-handed historian and truth-teller who has put us all in his debt, is still, I think, mistaken when he suggests that most of our woes derive from idealists, social engineers, and utopians. He is correct in his way, and we shall never again be able to look indulgently on the sort of radical who claims to act like a pitiless surgeon or a ruthless engineer. However, as often as not, you will find that, whatever the high-sounding pretext may be, the worst crimes are still committed in the name of the old traditional rubbish, of loyalty to nation, or order, or leadership, or tribe, or faith. To train the condemnation upon the utopians is to miss the historical point, the point made in Animal Farm, among other places, that utopians become tyrants when they start to emulate their former masters. It is also to miss the teleological point that we are somehow so constituted as to feel the permanent lash of discontent. It is not possible to immunize people against the hope of extraordinary change. Soviet psychosurgeons, as Conquest well knows, would place dissidents in mental wards and medicate them forcibly for reformist delusion. Thus, the only sane people in society were classified as deranged and antisocial. This practice was not the work of wide-eyed or passionate utopians. The high ambition, therefore, seems to me to be this, that one should strive to combine the maximum of impatience with the maximum of scepticism, the maximum of hatred, of injustice and irrationality with the maximum of ironic self-criticism. This would mean really deciding to learn from history rather than invoking or sloganizing it. Envoi. In his haunting little book, Minima Moralia, Theodore Adorno wrote that an artistically satisfying film could doubtless be made, meeting all the conditions and limitations imposed by the Hays Office, the Hollywood censor of the day, but only as long as there was no Hays Office. I have always taken that brilliantly gnomic observation to imply the following two things. First, virtue and merit can become their opposites if they are exacted or compelled. Second, no self-description or definition can be relied upon. An official of the Teamsters Union, asked by a Senate hearing if his union was really powerful, responded guardedly but elegantly by saying that being powerful was a little like being ladylike. If you have to say you are, you probably ain't. I have not, throughout our correspondence, been quite able to shake off a slight sense of imposture. If you define me as an authority on the radical, you may be under an illusion. If I take your invitation at face value, I may be making a fool of myself. An early tutor of mine in radical journalism, the late James Cameron, once confessed that every time he addressed the typewriter, he thought to himself, "Today is the day they are going to find me out." He had been the great chronicler of Indian independence, and when he died was the only man who had seen three nuclear explosions. I am consoled when I suffer this very same apprehension by the thought that the Pope and the Queen and the President all wake up every morning with a similar gnawing fear, or that, if they do not, they deserve to be doubted and distrusted even more, if that were possible, than I doubt and distrust them now. So I have no peroration or clarion note on which to close. Beware the irrational, however seductive. Shun the transcendent and all who invite you to subordinate or annihilate yourself. Distrust compassion. Prefer dignity for yourself and others. Don't be afraid to be thought arrogant or selfish. Picture all experts as if they were mammals. Never be a spectator of unfairness or stupidity. Seek out argument and disputation for their own sake. The grave will supply plenty of time for silence. Suspect your own motives and all excuses. Do not live for others any more than you would expect others to live for you. I shall leave you with a few words from George Conrad, the Hungarian dissident who retained his integrity through some crepuscular times and who survived his persecutors by writing Anti-Politics and The Loser and many other lapidary essays and fictions. When, after the emancipation of his country and society, they came to him and offered him the presidency, he said, "No thanks." He wrote this in 1987, when the dawn seemed a good way off. Have a lived life instead of a career. Put yourself in the safekeeping of good taste. Lived freedom will compensate you for a few losses. If you don't like the style of others, cultivate your own. Get to know the tricks of reproduction. Be a self-publisher, even in conversation, and then the joy of working can fill your days. May it be so with you, and may you keep your powder dry for the battles ahead, and know when and how to recognize them.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Letters to a Young Contrarian, written by Christopher Hitchens, narrated by James Adams. Executive Producer, Jennifer Basick. Producer, Mike Charzik. Production Coordinator, Kat Lambrix. Edited by Greg Lawrence. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2001 by Christopher Hitchens. Production copyright 2010 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.